We come to a passage that is, I think, of all the Bible stories, this is the story with the most merch. This is the story with the most children's toys. In fact, there'll be quite a few people here growing up who had a Noah's Ark at home. Does anybody want to own up to having a Noah? Yeah, good to see, James. Yeah, we've got one man who's... There are more here, I'm sure. And the story that... we had actually an ark here in the morning that one of the parents had brought along, and he showed us the two giraffes and the two this and the two that. And that's the happy side of the story. And it's a lovely story, and I remember my kids loving hearing this story, and the pictures are great. And yet, really, this story is awful. It's, I think, amongst the most terrifying stories in the whole of the Bible. This is a fraction of Gustav Dorff's engraving. And in the original, it's a bigger thing, but there's a huge expanse of empty sea and one lone rock and frightened children on the rock and others slipping into the sea. And when I worked in radio journalism, we had to write a lot of news stories that were pretty confronting. But I remember typing a news story, this sentence: an earthquake in Albania overnight has killed 100,000 people. And then going on the air and reading that out on the news. And I mean, that is an almost incomprehensible sentence for us when you think of 100,000 families. And yet this is bigger, much bigger. So we're not talking about a cute story, we're talking about a universal catastrophe that engulfed all of humanity except for one man and his family, and it actually happened. In that every ancient culture has a story of a devastating flood, and even in this account, dates are given. So just look at chapter 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the sources of the vast watery depth burst open. Or chapter 8, verse 4, the ark came to rest in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. Or chapter 8, verse 13, in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first day of the month. The author is making sure that we know. He's giving us dates to remind us this is real. And yes, it's true. Other ancient cultures, other ancient Mesopotamian texts, famous one like the Epic of Gilgamesh, also record stories of ancient floods with striking similarities. And God did it. We might be tempted to want to pass this off as something that God allowed. Perhaps God was distracted and it happened. But no, as we read this tonight, we're going to see this is God overseeing, God directing, God making this happen. And actually, that, for some of us, it's going to challenge our whole view of who is God and what is God capable of. I found this Spanish author, Juan Arias. He wrote a book, The God I Don't Believe In. Now, he's creating a straw man here, but he says, I'll never believe in a God who makes himself feared. I'll never believe in a God who condemns. I'll never believe in a God who sends people to hell. I'll never believe in a God who actually says, you'll pay for that. There's retribution. I'll never believe in a God who prefers purity. And now, he sets up straw men in some of those things, but I want to say, this God does bring about this flood. He's not exactly the same straw man that Juan Arias is setting up, but he is a God who brings judgment. Now, as we have led up to tonight's talk, a number of people have put questions to me, questions like, was the flood literally worldwide? What about Australia? What even about Tasmania? Did it flood there? Or, I mean, and who cares? Harsh but fair, yeah. There are some. Is there anyone here from Tasmania? See, no one's from Tasmania. some hold to a literal worldwide flood. I mean, it's a safe space. You can tell us. We won't judge you. Yeah. Okay. Some hold to a literal worldwide flood. They argued geological evidence, fossil layers, sedimentation, marine fossils on mountains, that it all fits with that. But others say the flood was real, catastrophic, but regional. What do I think? Well, I just want to note, firstly, this is before they've worked out that the world was a sphere. And the existence of the flood is less important than the extent of the flood. But for the purpose of this narrative, and for the purpose of the first readers, it's everywhere. And the first readers, Moses, is attempting to teach them, what is Yahweh, the Lord, like? Who is this God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? And well, we discover in these chapters that he's omnipotent, that he's just, that he judges, and that he is merciful. And that this God who brought you out of Egypt, that's not a one-off act. This is an action that is consistent with the pattern of his character. And so questions like, were the kangaroos in the ark? Or did Central Australia flood? The text is not designed to answer that question. I mean, there are all sorts of moments where people look for information in the wrong place. You don't go looking for poetry in a physics book. You don't go looking for recipes in Google Maps. You know, there are different texts designed to tell you, answer different questions. I'm at point two. Here we go. Here's what's really going on. God's created world, and we have in chapter 6, verse 1, the snowballing of sin. So remember, we saw 3 weeks ago the first sin, Adam and Eve. They declare autonomy. They want to go their own way, rejecting God. And then since then, we saw the last couple of weeks, there was a spiraling increase in sin. We go from disobedience to murder to reckless killing to titanic lust to total corruption and violence. And in every way, sin and its destructiveness is growing in power like a snowball, gathering speed and size as it hurtles down a hill until it's completely out of control. And so chapter 6 begins, when mankind began to multiply on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of mankind were beautiful, and they took any they chose as wives for themselves. The sons of God, the spirit people, took human women to have sex with them. Now, let's pause and think about that for a sec. When the world was created, the animals were created according to their kinds, to create, relate according to their kinds. You stay in your lane. A dog has sex with a dog. A cat has sex with a cat. It would be wrong for a human to have sex with a cat or any of that. A human to have sex with a monkey. We call that bestiality in our culture. And yet what's happening here is not just that. It's not just crossing of the species barrier. It seems to be a crossing of a spiritual barrier where human women are sexually intimate with spirit beings. This is a boundary crossing breakdown of God's intention for his creation. They are breaching the boundaries between heaven and earth. They are grasping at immortality by having sexual relations with the spirit. This is not how God meant things to be. And God sees this. See that point B? When God saw that human wickedness was widespread on the earth and that every inclination of the human mind was always evil all the time. Just feel that for a minute. Every inclination of the human mind was always evil all the time. The other day, I was invited to be a guest on a podcast a podcast for Christian ministry leaders. And it was a bit of a surprise to me because I do a podcast for Christian ministry leaders, but I was invited to be on another one by somebody else. And he said, the topic I want you to come and talk about is the book, a book that you reckon every Christian ministry leader should read. And I've been thinking about that for a few days, and I thought, there's a whole lot of predictable answers that other people will give. And I don't want to give that answer. I want to give an unpredictable answer, but I also want to give an answer that every Christian... And I thought of an answer. I thought of a 17th century non-Christian diarist from Great Britain, a guy called Samuel Pepys. And this is a fine moment to grab a phone and Google him if you like. But Samuel Pepys wrote a diary for every day of his adult life. He was a senior civil servant in the UK. Just as the place became a republic under Cromwell, and then he stayed a senior civil servant, head of the Navy under Cromwell, and managed to survive the monarchy coming back. So he stayed as a senior civil servant through two major changes of government. And he wrote this diary, and he somehow arranged for his diary to be hidden so that no one would ever see it for 100 years, and then it would be released, and all sorts of people have read it, and I've read it. It's frightening to read this man's diary. Because you read this man's diary and he talks about lusting after his servant girl, and he talks about his plan to dominate and his plan to manipulate. And I mean, all those kind of things you can read in fiction, but here is somebody being totally honest about the blackness, the total wickedness of his heart. And as I read his diary and saw the thoughts that he had that he would never have let a 17th century person see, I thought about the thoughts that I've had that I would never let you see. And I'm hoping at this moment you're thinking about, are you like me, that you curate your thoughts for public consumption and you don't actually let people see how dreadfully wicked inside you really are? Every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. Now, feel the contrast between where the world is at this point, Genesis 6, verse 1, only evil all the time, and where we were back in chapter 1, verse 31, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. It is a totally different situation. Now, God sees that our thoughts are wicked. And so verse 7, God resolves, I will wipe mankind who I created off the face of the earth, together with the animals, creatures that crawl, and the birds of the sky. I regret that I made them. God resolves to uncreate his creation. And so though Noah found favor with the Lord, verse 8, these are the family records of Noah. Noah is righteous, blameless among his contemporaries. He wore. Who is Noah? Noah is the grandson of Seth. The Seth was the son of Adam. Adam was the wife of Eve. God had said to the serpent of Eve, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. We're chasing down the family tree, looking for the offspring of Eve, who's going to do battle with the devil. And we get to chapter 6, and every inclination of all their hearts is only evil all the time, except one man is the good guy. This is the son of Eve, and we're thinking he's going to be the one who's going to put things right, who's going to do battle with the devil. And how's it going to happen? Well, God gives instructions to Noah to build an ark, and he starts to build. Noah trusts and obeys, and we're off to a good start. There's obedience from Noah. Chapter 6, verse 22, Noah did this. He did everything the Lord commanded him. Chapter 7, verse 5, Noah did everything the Lord commanded him. The point is being thumped that Noah is being, in fact, not just Noah. Chapter 7, 9, two of each, male and female, came to Noah, entered the ark, just as the Lord commanded him. The whole world Every inclination is only evil all the time. And one man, time after time after time after time, he trusts and obeys. What does God do? God, having created the world, uncreates the world. So this is not just a big rainstorm. This is not just the biggest ever rainstorm. This is the uncreation of the world. Let me show it to you in three different ways. The creation account in Genesis 1 and the uncreation account in Genesis 6 and 7. What was the world like right at the beginning of the Bible? It was watery chaos. If you go back to Genesis 1, verse 2, we'll put that up on the screen. The earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths. The Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters. All there was water. And God separated the water from the waters above, the waters below. Dry land separated the seas. And then we get to chapter 5 and the civilization and cities and music. And now we go back to water, to watery chaos. The dry land is covered. See how the reversal is hinted at here. Chapter 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the day, all the sources of the vast watery depths burst open. The floodgates of the sky were going back to water. Second thing, there's a deliberate, systematic wiping out of the creature lists. Back in Genesis 1, there were creature lists. Chapter 1, verse 24, let the earth produce living creatures according to their kinds. Livestock, creatures that crawl, the wildlife of the earth, according to their kinds. And this is explicitly undone in chapter 6. The Lord said, chapter 6, verse 7, I will wipe mankind who I have created off the face of the earth, together with the animals, with the creatures that crawl, with the birds of the sky. I regret that I made them. And then we see in chapter 2, verse 7, this is point C, God had breathed breath of life into humanity. Chapter 2, 7, the Lord God formed the man out of the dust from the ground, breathed the breath of life into his nostrils. The man became a living being. Chapter 7, verse 22, everything with the breath of life, the breath of the Spirit of life in its nostrils, everything on dry land died. It's the systematic, structured, ordered undoing of creation. Uncreation. Then, point four, we get to chapter 8 and God recreates the world. Chapter 8, verse 1, God remembers Noah and starts all over again. And when he does it with just the same as in chapter 1, his breath, his spirit, the wind hovering over the waters. Let me give it to you from chapter 8, verse 1, God remembered Noah as well as all the wildlife and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. God caused a breath, wind, spirit to pass over the earth. The water began to subside. That's a parallel, direct parallel back to Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and empty. Darkness covered the surface of the watery depths, and the Spirit of God hovered over the surface of the waters. Then, when the animals come out of the ark, they're given the same commission as back in Genesis. Chapter 8, verse 17. Bring out all the living creatures that are with you. Bring out birds and livestock, all those that crawl on the earth, and they will spread over the earth, be fruitful and multiply over all the earth. Go have babies increase. Same thing that God had said back in chapter 1, verse 20. God said, let the water swarm with living creatures. Let the birds fly above the earth. Pardon me. Let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the large sea creatures and every living creature that moves and swarms with the water according to their kinds. He created every winged creature according to its kind. God saw that it was good. God blessed them. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the waters of the seas, let the birds multiply. It's the same command in the recreation of the world. And then God speaks to Noah. God blesses Noah. His command to Noah is very close to his command to humanity back in chapter 1. So chapter 9, verse 1, God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Exactly the same thing that he said back in chapter 1, verse 28. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth, subdue the earth, rule. We are meant to see. And I hope I've persuaded you that after the destruction of the flood, God is starting over again. So what do we see in chapters 6 through 9? Or 1 to 9, we see creation. Chapter 6, uncreation. Chapter 8, recreation. Now, we get to the end of the flood. And remember, if we were following down that family tree and God had said to the serpent that the woman's son, he's the one who's going to crush you, and we're looking for the son of the woman who will actually put things right, restore order in God. We're thinking, Noah's the guy. He's the one. We've got high hopes for Noah. And is it going to be better, or is it just going to go wrong with the next generation again? And the answer is Noah the one? Yes and no. Yes, Noah is the one to put things right. Chapter 6, verse 18. Chapter 6, verse 18, here's the yes answer. God says, God to Noah, I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark with your sons, your wife, and your son's wife. So God makes a promise before the flood to Noah. You're going to be the one, Noah. I'm going to make this covenant, this contract, and you're going to be the one who brings, through your family, blessing to the world. And immediately, actually, after the flood, it's looking good, chapter 8, verse 20, immediately Noah offers a sacrifice to God. Chapter 8, verse 20, Noah built an altar to the Lord. He took some of every kind of clean animal and every kind of clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. He kept all these animals all the way through the flood, and now he offers them to God. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma. He said to himself, I'll never again curse the ground because of human beings, even though the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth onward. Our hearts don't get better. But he says, I'll never again strike down every living thing as I've done. After the flood, God resolves not to flood the earth again, despite the fact that all of our hearts continue to be evil from childhood. Why? Well, Noah's offered a sacrifice. What kind of sacrifice? Was it thanksgiving for the safe delivery through the flood? Was it atonement for sin? Yes, I think probably both. Noah has kind of acted as the first priest, the first mediator, and God is satisfied with the actions of Noah. And so we're thinking at this point, Noah could be the one. But no, Noah's not the one. If you look at chapter 9, there's a pretty messy moment in, where is it? I've just lost it. Noah's lying around, naked. Verse 18 in chapter 9. Yeah. Noah's sons who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were Noah's sons, and from them the whole earth was populated. Noah, as a man of the soil, began by planting a vineyard. He drank some of the wine, became drunk, and uncovered himself inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked, told his two brothers outside. Shem, Ham, and Japheth took a cloak, placed it over their shoulders. Noah's not the good guy who's going to be the one who'll save the whole problems of the world. Okay, what's the message to us, just before we get to questions and comments? Some of us, we can say, Dominic, I felt questions they're not answered. Was Tasmania flooded? What about the kangaroos? Is the ground still cursed? Who are the Nephilim? But I just want to say, don't let your questions get in the way of listening to what the chapters are trying to tell us. Because the message that the chapters are trying to tell us is actually absolutely crystal clear. First word from these chapters, God has it in him to judge. This is part of God's character. God will not tolerate ongoing rebellion against him. God will judge. I need to take stock of my life, the actions in my life. You need to take stock in your life. God will judge us. Second thing we see in this chapter, God has it in him to save. So, chapter 7, verse 16. This verse jumped out at me. Then the Lord shut him in. God's told Noah, build the ark. Noah's built the ark. All the animals have come into the ark. And then what happens? There's a door there. And God shuts the door. God closes the door. You know, you're on a plane. You get on the plane and you sit there and you're just sitting there, and just before it's about to take off, the stewardess comes and that enormous door, they pull it in and turn that big handle and it's closed. And you think, I hope that stays closed. Well, here is a big door right on the front of the ark that is closed by God. Now, you've probably heard of the great preacher Billy Graham. He still holds the record for the most number of people. I mean, you would think the biggest crowd ever gathered in Sydney was, I don't know, a Taylor Swift concert or something. But the biggest crowd ever gathered in Sydney was the Sydney Cricket Ground 1959 for the final night of the Billy Graham Crusade. And in fact, they not just filled the whole of the Sydney Cricket Ground, but they filled the whole of the Sydney Sports Stadium next door. And the same thing happened 2 months earlier in Melbourne. The biggest crowd ever at the MCG is not an AFL Grand Final. The biggest crowd ever was the Billy Graham night in 1959. I've only heard one talk ever by Billy Graham. A long time ago, I got a cassette of a talk by, and it was the final afternoon of the 1959 Billy Graham Crusade. And somehow I managed to get this cassette, and I was listening to him, and he preached. I mean, it was raining in Sydney, and it was belting down, and I don't know, 100,000 people in the Sydney Cricket Ground. And what did this belting, pouring rain in Sydney, Billy Graham preached on Noah's Ark, and he spoke of God shutting the door. And then he said, Jesus came and said, I am the door. Now, let me give it to you. This is John chapter 7, Jesus speaking. Jesus said, truly I tell you, I am the gate, the door for the sheep. All who ever came before me were thieves and robbers. The sheep didn't listen to them. I am the gate. I am the entrance. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will come in and go out and find pasture. If you want to escape the judgment of God, the door is Jesus. Your heart is every bit as wicked as the hearts of people of Noah's time. My heart is every bit as wicked. The only way to be saved is to go in the door. The door, though, it's not a physical door now, a literal door, it's a metaphorical door. The only way to be saved is to trust in Jesus. And Jesus, he says, he goes on actually, he reminds us as we go through life today, God's judgment is coming. He says, look at this, Matthew 24, verse 37, that as in the days of Noah, so the coming of the Son of Man will be. Jesus is going to return. In the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage until the day that Noah boarded the ark. They didn't know until the flood came and swept them away. This is the way the coming of the Son of Man will be. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, one left, just as it was in Noah's time. You'll be going through your life. Some people are studying for exams at the moment. Some people are applying for jobs at the moment. Some people are getting pregnant at the moment. You're doing all those kind of things, but you don't know when Jesus is coming. It could be tonight. It could be before you go to work tomorrow. It could be next weekend. What would Billy Graham say? He would say, have you walked through the door? Are you safe? Are you saved? Or are you under the judgment of God? If I had to critique the Christian ministry that I've done over the years, I'm sure all sorts of other people would have all sorts of different critiques, but if I had to offer a critique, one of my critiques would be that in the way that we have constructed the ministry here, and it's been an attempt to present the Christian message in a contemporary way that will get a hearing with Western secularists in the inner west of Sydney, we've said, come along, check it out, explore. Come along, check out, explore the Introducing God course. Come along, check it out, ask questions. No questions off limit. Yeah, we'll think about it. And over time, the logic builds and people become convinced. But we just keep coming back. But do we actually say, he might come back tonight? He might return tonight. Are you ready tonight? Are you driving carefully just in case you have an accident tonight? This is the kind of message that we get here in this passage. Be ready. And actually, Christian friend, be ready. This is not just a message to the non-Christians, though it is a message to me. I've got to think about the people I really love who are not ready. I want to go talking to them. But what about your life, Christian friend? If you're a Christian, what kind of life are you living at the moment? Are you living conscious that Jesus might come back tonight? Let me give it to you from 2 Peter 3. This is what he says, 2 Peter 3, verse 3. Above all, be aware of this. Scoffers will come in the last days, scoffing and following their own evil desires, saying, where is this coming that he promised? Ever since our ancestors fell asleep, everything continues as they have been since the beginning of creation. But they deliberately forget. They deliberately overlook this. What do they deliberately forget? They deliberately forget that by the word of God, the heavens came into being long ago, Genesis 1. The earth was brought about from water through water, Genesis 1. Through these, the world of that time perished, Genesis 6, when it was flooded, and by the same word, the present heavens and earth are stored up for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. He says people deliberately forget this. I had a friend, two friends of mine. They were married, and she wanted to get pregnant, and he wasn't ready for them to have a baby. The contraceptive they were using was the contraceptive pill. It relied on her remembering to take it each morning. And she said, oh, Dominic, I was so tempted to forget. Every morning I'd stand there at the medicine cabinet saying, I want a baby. He doesn't want one yet. Maybe I'll just forget today. Maybe I'll deliberately forget. But there was nothing deliberate. I mean, there was nothing accidental about that forgetting. It was intentional. I'm going to forget. And here's the thing. People today, Christian people today, we push aside the news that God might come back. We push aside the news that there's going to be a judgment day, an accounting day. Because look, he says, chapter 3, verse 8 of 2 Peter, dear friends, don't overlook this one fact. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, 1,000 years like a day. The Lord doesn't delay his promise, as some understand delay, but he's patient, not wanting anyone to perish, but to come to repentance. So he has held on because there's two people that I really love who I desperately long to come to Christian faith. I desperately long for them to be inside the ark. I desperately long for them to know and trust Jesus. I desperately long for them to be safe. And so I want him to hang on. But then he says, verse 10, the day of the Lord will come like a thief. On that day the heavens will pass away with a loud noise. The elements will burn and be dissolved, and the earth and the works on it will be disclosed. And since these things are going to be dissolved in this way, what kind of people should you be, Village Church? You should be holy conduct and godliness. Be holy. Whatever it is that you're doing, it doesn't matter, this little sin. It does matter, because he might come back tonight. That day, the heavens will be dissolved by fire. The elements will melt with heat. But based on his promise, he's going to do this. We wait for the new heavens and the new earth where righteousness dwells. So what should you do? How should you live? Verse 14, while you wait, this is what you should do. Make every effort to be found without spot or blemish, in his sight at peace. There are moments when I think, it doesn't matter, I could just watch this on Netflix. It will be fine. That's not the way to think. That's the wrong way to think. If you know that it's leading you away from Jesus, I don't want to be a person with spot or blemish in his sight. I want to be a person who can look at the Lord Jesus and say, I've acted rightly before you. I listened to how you wanted me to live. The way I reacted in that situation, it wasn't me acting badly. It was me acting the way Jesus would want me to. I want to live a holy, blameless life. Well, there you are. That's what I think the message of Genesis 6 through to 9 is.